I'm Sean Graham, and what's oldest news this week is trade and art. Of course, in the news recently, there has been a lot of discussion about trade, free trade in particular, the role of tariffs in 2025, how they're going to shape the relationship between Canada, the United States, and Mexico. The United States, under the Trump administration, has touted tariffs as a major component of their economic policy. The response from both Canada and Mexico has been decidedly not positive to the implementation of those tariffs. And there is one area that certainly in Canada does often get some attention to it when we're talking about trade and access to markets. That is culture and popular culture and how things like CanCon laws, the actual exchange of culture, popular culture, art, music, that kind of thing, how that plays into broader patterns of trade and trade agreements doesn't get necessarily as much attention in the press as does the exchange of manufactured goods, but certainly it is a significant part of the story, and it is the subject of a new book by Sarah E. K. Smith entitled Trading on Art, Cultural Diplomacy, and Free Trade in North America. And in this book, Sarah profiles the role of art, and she'll explain visual art, as it relates to trade through the end of the 20th century into the 21st century. And she explores how art and artworks, exhibitions, museum programs from roughly the 1980s through the 2010s, and shows how these pieces and these exhibitions reflected free trade and how people were thinking about free trade in all three of Canada, the United States, and Mexico. And it really is a wonderful lens through which to analyze these particular pieces of art. Because as I said, oftentimes these discussions very much focus on manufactured goods and also resources, oil, potash, and certainly in the Canadian context, supply management gets a lot of attention as well. But we don't spend that much time in the popular press about art and culture. So I was very excited to see this book, not only because it taught me something about art, but also Sarah is a friend of mine. We've known each other for a little over a decade at this point. Met doing our postdocs about a decade ago. So always excited when a friend of mine has their book come out, especially one as good as Sarah's book here. So she was nice enough to give me some time to talk all about it. Really enjoyed the conversation, and I think you will as well. So let's get right into my chat with Sarah E. K. Smith. All right. And Sarah E. K. Smith joins me now. Sarah, how are you today?
Great. Thanks for having me, Sean.
Great to have you back on the show to talk about Trading on Art, Cultural Diplomacy in North America. This book is, when we first met 10 years ago or such, this was the subject matter that you were working on. And as I said in the intro, makes the connection between art and free trade. So just broad strokes to start us off, Sarah. What got you interested in, I mean, you're an art historian, so obviously you're interested in art, but why free trade? How does that come in? Because I don't meet a lot of art historians, well, in general, but art historians who are necessarily interested in, say, trade policy. So like, where does that come in for you? Like, where did that interest come from?
Yeah. You know, for me, this is part of my interest in thinking through the economic and political dimensions of art practice. So I have a longstanding interest in cultural diplomacy. So how, culture is used to navigate international relations, you know, influence people, how culture is used to tell different narratives that might really align with foreign policy goals. So as part of that, I was really struck by the moment of free trade in North America, because there's this paradox around culture and free trade. So culture, in my research, I found was really used to promote a vision of North America. It's really used to circulate narratives about North American unity. But at the same time, there's actually a cultural exemption. So an explicit exemption in the trade deal, in the trade deals that exempts the cultural industry. So I was really thinking about, you know, how we feel that culture is not a part of free trade histories, but at the same time, my work reveals that it's, you know, really implicated in a lot of key ways in these discussions.
So when you say that culture is exempt, are we talking like, so this is how we get away with like CanCon laws and yes. Right, it's like, so the Canadian radio stations have to play a certain amount of Canadian music, so those are not included in these trade agreements at all?
Yes, there's something called the cultural exemption. This cultural exemption clause is something that originates in the 1980s with the free trade agreement that was signed between Canada and the U.S. And there's a lot of Canadian emphasis on cultural exemption, and it explicitly exempts the cultural industries from these trade agreements. And that's a clause that has continued on in NAFTA, which is now the Canada-US-Mexico agreement. And it's also something that Canada has deployed in other free trade agreements globally.
And how much of that is originated by Canada, and how much in the North American context, and how much by Mexico? I would imagine the United States doesn't really care about protecting its, it is the cultural, at least pop culture leader in the world and exporting stuff. But when you're talking about these international agreements, obviously Canadian content has long been a concern. I mean, the stuff I do in the 1930s with radio, a lot of concern about Canadian content there. But when you're talking, when we get into the 1980s, this area, the era where you're starting with this book, what is Canada's primary concern at that point? And why is it a, why is it part of these broader agreements? Because theoretically, art and auto manufacturing don't seem all that connected.
Yes, absolutely. And I think important to remember that in the 80s, what is happening is Canada and the US are entering into a free trade agreement, which comes into play in 1989. And at that moment, Mexico is not part of the conversation. And, you know, maybe perhaps we could draw some parallels to today. But in that moment in the 80s, there's a lot of anxiety on behalf of Canadians about U.S. power, about U.S. cultural imperialism, about Canadian culture being perceived as not as dominant, whether in a market sense or I think there's different ways we can think about how culture is operating in terms of cultural industries or in terms of, you know, specific artists and their kind of visual material culture. There's a lot of anxiety going on around that. So the cultural exemption is put into that 1989 agreement, and then it is something that is basically carried over into NAFTA, which expands the trade agreement to bring Mexico into this North American partnership.
And is this primarily English Canadian artists and cultural producers? Because it strikes me that Quebec has long been more isolated on this question because of the protection that language offers it, or at least French Canada, not just Quebec, but French Canada in general. So are these exemptions mostly geared and being pushed by English Canada?
That's interesting. So I don't know the answer to that. The exemptions would protect any cultural industries. But what is interesting about the Quebec question is not that Quebec is isolated, because in my research on cultural diplomacy, Quebec actually has such strong international ties. Quebec, of course, is part of La Francophonie. Quebec has these historic ties to France. And even a lot of, if you're thinking broadly in the 20th century, developments around Canadian cultural diplomacy from the federal government, often the English, quote unquote, English Canadian government is a bit of a pace behind what's happening at the provincial level in Quebec. And so there's a scholar, Evan Potter, and others who have written on this idea that some of what Quebec is doing on the international stage then prompts the Canadian federal government to kind of look further into how they can use Canadian culture to promote the nation.
Very interesting that Quebec leading the way in that regard. So when we get into in the 1980s, and we're talking, I mean, it's very interesting that we're talking as we record this just before an election that is centered largely on questions of free trade and relationship with the United States. And that's what the 1988 election is largely about as well. But when we're talking about cultural exemption and art, I want to be clear about what you're talking about in the book, because the cultural exemption applies to a lot of different things, but the focus of the book is visual art.
Correct? Yeah. Yeah. And so I do want to be clear about that, that paradox or the cultural exemption. So the cultural exemption applies to the cultural industries. So creative industries, we're talking about the commercial production of things like film and music. And in the book, I'm talking about culture as evidenced in visual material production. So I'm thinking specifically about fine art or visual art and exhibitions of fine art and visual art. So I'm looking specifically at art galleries and museums, you know, at all types of different artworks like paintings, sculpture, video work, installations. But that is very different than, say, you know, a commercially produced film.
Right. So the stuff that we would associate usually with an art historian.
Yes, like yes, that my bread and butter, yes.
Yeah, the stuff that you don't really like. All right, so let's go through the book a little bit and sort of, because it doesn't have a fully chronological approach, which I love. I love thematic approaches. It's great. So the first section gets into art exhibits, and the first chapter is about Mexican art in Canada and the exhibition of Mexican culture in Canada. And it was really fascinating to me. We were talking before we recorded, and you said that there was this tension and this idea that these two countries didn't really know each other. And so Mexican art coming to Canada was a way of letting Canadians get a sense of what Mexico was all about, what the Mexican culture was. Where does that come from? There's an international exhibition going on. Is it Canadian art galleries wanting to bring in Mexican material, Mexican artists and curators pushing to get into Canada? Like, how does something like that even come about? And how does it become a trend such that you can identify it and write about it?
Yeah. Okay, well, a few parts of that question. So in terms of the book, it is ordered roughly chronologically. It has six chapters that are around three distinct sections. And the one you're talking about, the first section, is called Exhibiting Diplomacy. So broadly, that section is examining exhibitions and institutions as a form of cultural diplomacy. And this is setting the stage for free trade. So I'm looking at around the 1940s, right up into the end of the 20th century. And the chapter the first chapter of the book, Mexican Art in Canada, is precisely that, looking at, you know, if we're thinking about what changed with NAFTA, when we see a surge of cultural initiatives exchanging cultural materials between Canada and Mexico, specifically visual art exhibitions, like how to understand that as an art historian, I need to understand what sets the scene. So that took me to the National Gallery archives in terms of looking at how frequent had exhibition exchanges been between Canada and Mexico in the 20th century, like what was different, if anything. And so your question about how this comes about, there's many different ways art exhibitions come about. And in my book, I'm really clear that I'm looking primarily at the National Gallery and major Canadian art galleries and museums, rather than, say, artist-run centers or commercial galleries, which are other ways that you could investigate this history. And part of that is because I'm interested in how the state government saw art exhibitions as a means to connect and what they saw was worthwhile. So I'm looking through the correspondence, trying to get a sense of how people in Ottawa might have thought this aligned with their priorities, or how people in missions and embassies abroad also might have advocated. So in some of the shows I look at, you could see that it would be people on the ground in those countries who were representatives of Canada saying, you know, we should have an art exhibition, or this is something that might matter or be important. This might be a way to share information about Canada with others, or exhibitions might be instigated, you know, really within the art sphere by a curator with a particular interest. I think it's important to remember that Mexican art was very popular internationally in the 20th century, so it was certainly on the radar. And there is a period. So in the book, I have this chart where I go through the different exhibitions of Mexican art that circulated in Canada, and I kind of come up with four key ones, and they start in 1943. And what was really important to me is to understand what's going what's happening politically in that moment. So in 1943, part of it is about showing alliances during the Second World War. Right. And so there's these different political moments. So I find that even though there might be particular aesthetic conversations going on, you know, conversations about artists, there's also sometimes this layer of urgency that comes into play when you want to commemorate kind of different moments in a nation's history or different moments of friendship and connection with other countries, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm curious, though, in doing so, what about questions of scale? Mm-hmm. For audience, like when you're looking at national institutions and these art exhibitions, like, yeah, it's great to have art that talks about alliances and friendship and all that. But how many people, like, does it matter how many people see the exhibitions and engage with the art?
Yeah, that's a great question, because for me, I think we can look at that. Certainly, when you're talking about impact, audience is an important question. But in this 1943 exhibition, Mexican Art Today, that I looked at, this was a touring exhibition. So it didn't just go to one place and impact one audience. This was an exhibition that was seen in Ottawa, in Toronto, in Montreal, and then out on the West Coast. So, you know, if you have a touring dimension to a show, that increases the impact and the audience. And there's two other things that are important, because I think sometimes people don't necessarily see an exhibition, but they might learn about it through advertisements. They might read media coverage of it, and they might kind of understand some of the key narratives of that exhibition without actually going to the museum and seeing the exhibition themselves. So that is another dimension that I think is sometimes discounted. And the third dimension is this idea of exhibitions forging a space for people to build ties. So that might happen at a professional level in terms of, you know, connecting curators and museum professionals who work on these shows and facilitate these exchanges. Or this might be also something that happens at the opening. You know, it often these openings become spectacles or meeting grounds in which diplomatic encounters take place, right? When you look at these exhibitions, you know, people come to the inauguration. There's moments where different types of actors, including government actors, can give speeches and talk about what the exhibition means. So I think when we're understanding impact, it has to go beyond the individual visitor to the exhibition. And I should say too, a lot of what I study is, you know, what artists, curators, museums, politicians are saying matters about these exhibitions. I'm not doing audience reception studies, so I don't have polls of people who went to that 1943 exhibition to kind of know how they in fact received those messages.
Right. And the stuff that people are saying, is it explicit in, maybe not in front of an audience or in terms of the advertising for an art exhibition, but are they in the planning? Are they explicit of, say, the 1943 one? Well, we have, like, we're doing this because we want to forge the ties between the two countries. Is it that clear, that explicit in the materials that you're looking at?
Yes, it really varies in terms of what show or exhibition, but in the 1943 one, absolutely. So there was one of the people who attended the opening was the Mexican consul general, who gave a speech and he talked about growing mutual sympathy and understanding between Mexico and Canada, about ideas of an inter-American spirit, this idea of a great American family. And so what I trace in my research is, you know, not only those statements that were made at the exhibition opening, but how they also were picked up in the press across Canada. And that's another way that message was disseminated. And so there's varying levels of how explicit or implicit those ideas of or messages that kind of underpin some of these exhibitions are. But largely they're overt, I think.
So the next chapter, you look at Canadian art at 49th Parallel, and you've written about 49th Parallel before, and we've talked about it. But for anyone who doesn't know, like, what is 49th Parallel, and why is it so important to warrant its own chapter?
Yeah, 49th Parallel is a fascinating cultural diplomacy project that I feel like its history is little known. And so what it was a Canadian art gallery in New York, in Soho, which was the heart, heart of the art scene. And it operated between 1981 and 1992. So it lasted for a decade. And it was a project that was funded and initiated actually by what's now Global Affairs Canada. And so this isn't, the idea was that having the best, most exciting, innovative Canadian contemporary art on display in New York City would be a means of raising Canada's profile, a means of demonstrating to the US, you know, what Canada stood for, how it could be understood. And also in part of the mandate or mission for this was to spur economic activity. So they wanted to sell Canadian art, but also this idea that, you know, closer understanding between Canada and US might lead to better economic success between Canada and US. So 49th Parallel is fascinating also because it was a really key place for Canadian contemporary artists to get a foothold in New York. And I've looked at both the history of the administration of the gallery and also at some of the artists who exhibited there. So it, to me, it's a really interesting moment to understand the history of Canadian art, but also the history of Canadian cultural diplomacy.
Right. Well, it seems also to fit into, and maybe this changes by the time we get to the 1980s and 49th Parallel comes around, but certainly, again, if I can relate back to culture in the 1930s, there was a sense when the CBCs created that they needed the US to basically validate what they were doing. Like, it, does that exist in the art world too, that because New York is so associated with like the vanguard of art and new art movements, and it at least in North America strikes me as like the central hub of art, like, is there a sense of like Canada and Canadian artists are validated by having a space there? Does that play into it at all?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think if we think about art history broadly, you know, the center of the art world being in Europe, but then following the World War, it coming to New York. And certainly, you know, this is a gallery that's operating in the 80s, but there's a key Canadian artist who went to New York, you know, and it's, for instance, Michael Snow, Joyce Wieland, you know, they're going in earlier moments in the 60s and 70s, kind of to make it, to be a part of that scene. So I think this idea of cultural legitimacy is one way to understand this.
And what type of art is being produced? Like, if this is being put on by the Department of Foreign Affairs, or being sponsored by the Department of Foreign Affairs, and the artists are putting out work, and if there's this idea of, all right, we're talking about Canada to New York, Canada to the United States, and, you know, promote Canada, make Canada accessible, what type of art is in, like, what material, like, what are people seeing, and what are the artists creating in the hopes of doing that?
So this is a key question for 49th Parallel, because what's different about 49th Parallel is that they're interested in showing contemporary art and work that is more experimental or innovative. And so when I say contemporary art, I mean art by artists who are still living, and often art that is more recently produced. People define it in terms of different years, but the artist should be alive and it's likely made in the last couple of years. And so typically when you have cultural diplomacy initiatives, you might be showing a very different type of art. Often there is artists that are really associated with a national canon, national identity. So what often comes up in Canada is this legacy of the Group of Seven, who were Canadian landscape painters, and their work has certainly been circulated internationally. So we're talking about paintings of landscapes, you know, paintings of Algonquin Park. I'm sure you can understand the idea there.
Pretty then, vistas from, yes, of course.
And but when you come to 49th Parallel, what's interesting is they wanted to program a different type of art, and they were programming contemporary art. So, I mean, you might see two-dimensional works, but you also might see video works. You might see sculptures. You might see installation. It would be less representational. So you might be looking at something that's more of a conceptual piece where you wouldn't necessarily see figurative elements to it. And so that would be a type of art that is intended for a sophisticated art viewer, the kind of person who would be walking around Soho. The 49th Parallel was located in a great location. It was in a building that also housed a lot of other really established, well-known art galleries. And so it's a very different type of audience that they were trying to connect with.
Does it work? Like, that might be a too simplistic of a question, but like, how does this modern art, this sort of this new stuff, like how does it represent Canada? Like, is it, again, and we've talked about this before, I'm not smart enough to understand a lot of interpretive art or stuff that you really like. If it's a pretty picture, I get it. And if it's something that you really have to interpret, I struggle to do that. But if it's about, or if part of it is about promoting Canada and making those connections, like how explicit is the art in those, in making those messages and making that clear?
Yeah. You know, how do you tell it works? I mean, this is a key question for cultural diplomacy, this idea of metrics. We're trying to measure something that might, you know, take shape in terms of long-term relationships, in terms of trust or cultural understanding. These are very different, difficult things to measure. And so this question of, is it working? What is it doing? Plagues, 49th parallel, for its decade-long existence. So, you know, the government invested a lot of money in terms of, you know, securing this rent on this, in this extremely prestigious location, in terms of funding the art that was there, in terms of staffing this initiative. And it's plagued by these questions of, is it worth it? Is this money worth it? What is the art doing? And so I think this, there's different ways to think about it, but I think what's key to understand is that it is very difficult to obtain metrics. And I think we have to think about what it is doing. And in terms of building trust, in terms of building familiarity, it's not easy to ascertain. And so that is part of what leads to 49 parallel closing in the end. There is a lot of fiscal austerity. There's this sense that it's not worth it. There's a report that's done on the Canadian cultural centers, because 49th parallel is part of a constellation of places in the world that the Canadian government had at that time to showcase Canadian culture. But I think that you have to recognize they was trying to do something very different than teach people explicitly about Canada. It was more this idea that, you know, the best Canadian artists were having a place in the heart of the New York art world, and that people would come and be swayed by the art and then understand the Canadian connection subsequently.
Right. So it's not like a advertisement for Jasper, where it's supposed to just be the sweeping vistas of the mountains and beautiful and come here. It's more than that.
Absolutely. And this is part why I found 49th parallel so fascinating to study, because it's doing something different with cultural diplomacy, but also because there's a lot of correspondence that you can access where they're really agonizing over wanting to make this a space for Canadian art, but also wanting to avoid really explicit mention of Canada. So this is part of why it gets the name 49th parallel. It does have a slight name change throughout, but they're looking for something that signals, you know, this relationship between Canada and the US, but something that isn't, you know, so overt as like the Canadian Art Gallery.
So the second section of the book gets into art exhibitions and exhibiting. The third chapter is called Exhibiting the Continent. The second section is picturing North America. So when you're talking about art exhibits, what is the lens through which you're going to or looking at these, and how do you examine the role of exhibitions in this broader story?
Yeah, I'm really interested in exhibition history. So what I mean there is looking beyond the individual works that are on display and thinking more about an overall curatorial approach, you know, kind of the message that curators wanted to send through this arrangement of artwork, but also the funding that underpins it. You know, is this kind of funded by private interests, by, you know, government interests? You know, it's often a mix. And also, I'm interested in looking at exhibitions as meeting grounds. So, you know, who is there, who's talking about this exhibition. So tracing the rhetoric that circulates amongst exhibitions in the press. So often for my research, I'm going to museum archives and I'm looking through their exhibition files. So that traces everything that has to do with the show. So from the conception to kind of notes on the artwork, meetings between artists and curators, funding details, promotion and advertising. So how is this show distilled into a communication strategy. That's also of interest to me. So in this second section of the book, Picturing North America, this is really the core of the book. What I'm looking at is how exhibitions circulated ideas about North America that aligned with the free trade agreements that knit together Canada, Mexico, and the U.S.
Now, you've curated a bunch of stuff, so you know this and sort of know how curators think and put things together. And again, as somebody who's not an expert in art, when I go to a show, I'll read the thing, but it's not always clear to me, again, as very much not an art expert, as sometimes how things are related. So as curators are putting this together, like, how disparate can a show be visually to someone, but still have that theme hooked into it? And how much flexibility do curators have, especially in this era, based on maybe where the funding is coming from and overall purposes of the show, and just how much artistic freedom is there, and how do they kind of put these shows together in a way that fits in with some of these broader goals that you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of freedom, and curators are not necessarily thinking about the concerns that are guiding how I'm trying to read and unpack these exhibitions. So exhibitions can be visually incredibly disparate. You know, you might see a retrospective exhibition addressing the career of one artist, but find that artist has like several very distinctive styles that they've used throughout their career. So that's just one example that you can think of things being disparate. In terms of the exhibitions that I'm looking at, something that really tweaks my mind is how sometimes the same artworks are used to convey different messages about place. So a lot of my work is focusing on nationalism and how, you know, how we can rethink nationalism in the moment of free trade, in which we need to talk about the Canadian state as one that is connected to the Mexican and U.S., Mexico and U.S. So one of the exhibitions that I'm looking at is a show that travels to different places again. So it is a show that goes to Beijing during the Olympics, and it's a show that travels to Mexico as well. And so it was really interesting to me was to see how the curatorial framework, the curators make these decisions, they bring these works together, and it holds up, but how it is messaged in different ways and kind of performed in different ways by Canadian state actors to kind of show different ties between Canada and China and Canada and Mexico. So that's where I'm really interested in looking at these dynamics of exhibitions, because you can see the same art being used for different purposes in different moments. And that's something that came up when I looked at Mexican art in Canada, because some of the same modern art that you can read in relation to free trade agreements in the late 20th century is works that were shown in Canada in the 1940s, again, to talk about very different political circumstances.
That strikes me that that's one of the great challenges of studying any sort of cultural industry, is that the context in which it is consumed can change the meaning of the piece itself. And whatever the artist or the curator wants to get across, the audience is ultimately going to be the arbiter of what they take from it. And it's very difficult to predict what that's going to be.
Absolutely, yeah. And so in my research, I'm really clear that I don't look at audience or reception studies. I can't say for sure how people picked up these messages, but I'm really looking at artists and museums and politicians and policymakers to see what they were saying was happening in the moment.
Right, and they're changing based on the context, right? Like, so they're like, if they're in Beijing, they're saying this, and if they're in Mexico, they're saying this, and as temporally as well as we go through the 90s into the aughts, that's going to change because of the circumstances of the world, and the political, social, economic, cultural circumstances are going to change what is being said about the art as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and then we get into the question of indigeneity on this, and so the fourth chapter really addresses this issue. It strikes me as all three North American countries are colonial, and have each had their colonial past and are still trying to come to terms with broader questions of indigeneity and reconciliation. How does that manifest itself in the art exhibitions that you're looking at, and how do you address that as you're going through this chapter?
Yeah, and so it was really important to have a chapter thinking about, you know, settler colonialism in Canada and how this has a bearing on these exhibitions that were used to spin national narratives on the world stage. So in this chapter, I look at an exhibition called First Peoples of Canada. And so it's not all fine art that I'm looking at in this chapter. I'm looking at what I call exhibitions of visual material culture. So they can include artifacts, they might include films or photographs or things like that. So that's important to keep in mind. And I think in terms, what becomes important to look at is how Indigenous culture can be appropriated into Canadian national narratives, and to also understand in terms of the history of cultural diplomacy that Indigenous visual material culture has been used by the Canadian state to say things about the Canadian state, not about the communities from which this visual material culture originates. And I think that's something we should look at really critically. And there in the book, I get into how Indigenous peoples became something that was mobilized by the governments of Canada and Mexico as a point of commonality. So in thinking about the different ways to understand who they were, what they had in common, and how to promote that, Indigenous culture does come to the fore at different moments.
And in these examples, are Indigenous peoples and Indigenous artists given agency in the process, or is it very much, are you finding examples of appropriation and art taken out of the cultural context in which it's created for these nationalistic purposes?
It is nuanced, and it really depends on the particular initiative that I'm looking at. But certainly, we're finding ways in which that this is mobilized for an agenda that is not an agenda that is endorsed by the Indigenous groups who've created these artifacts. Like, this is a national. This is marshaled in support of the Canadian state. This is marshaled in support of promoting the Canadian state's ties with Mexico and the U.S. And so it kind of undercuts the sovereignty of Indigenous nations. So I chase different ways that this happens. I mean, and some of these just come through in terms of the exhibition history. So you can talk about, who is making the decisions, who own these collections, sometimes I look a lot at exhibition titles. So what is the starting title for a show, which is often something that's more descriptive and then nuanced later on in an exhibition. And so that can really give you insights into how people are understanding the culture that is at play. And I think part of this, so in this chapter, I look at these state-sponsored exhibitions, but I'm also looking at exhibitions that reveal different power structures. So one of the exhibitions that I look at is Remix, which is an exhibition of contemporary art that really went against the grain. So a lot of the shows in the book that I study have to do with promoting ties between the North American states, but this was an exhibition that really was critical about, the construction of nation states and really tried to assert Indigenous cultural producers' regional identities and kind of give us another way of thinking through the North American landscape. And so that is a show that was a lot of fun to get into.
All right, and let's get into then the last section of the book, which talked about resistance to some of these ideas. And the section is called Creating Resistance. And I don't know, maybe again, I like to preface all these questions with, I know nothing about art, but it strikes me that artists tend to be forces for resistance to broader trends, political, whatever it is. Is that a correct assumption or assessment on my part, that art and artists do tend to be prominent forms of resistance to whatever it is, like whatever cultural, political, economic structure, like, it just strikes me that art, has this fundamental underpinning of resistance to it.
I mean, I think we can't say that all artists are activists, but it's certainly in the research that I was doing on art in North America in the late 20th century and early aughts, there's a great and kind of rich stream of artists who are really agitating against free trade, or who are really grappling critically with what free trade would mean for Canada and what they thought about it. So this section of the book, Creating Resistance, I have two chapters. And one looks, chapter six looks at changing narratives of free trade in video art. And there's this whole kind of body of work in video art that was addressing free trade in the 80s and 90s. And I think it's not well recognized. And it also provides us all sorts of insights into how people thought about free trade and what it would mean for cultural producers. And there's certainly people who make this argument for artists as, you know, the key actors to stand up for cultural sovereignty, or artists as people who can read situations in novel ways and really kind of guide us. And I think art reflects the times. And I think it is important to see these art projects as giving us insights from the era. And one thing that's important to know about video art in this period is that a lot of video was used, of course, in protests. There's big sweeping protests against free trade in the period. A lot of it was videotaped, and a lot of artists produced experimental videos that sometimes reflect that footage, or, you know, incorporate protests footage into it. So that's also another fascinating angle.
If they're using this footage, like if I, like, again, I don't want to ask such a basic question, but what does that mean?
Yeah.
What does it mean? Yeah.
So what does it mean? It means that people were using video to document protests. You know, it's a form of documentation. It's also a form of protection if there's police brutality. There's many reasons you'd be documenting a protest, but then artists would have these interventions. So the video that I'm thinking of in particular, it's kind of a spoof off of like a who are you wearing on the red carpet kind of question. And so it's interviews with protesters at Quebec City and asking them, you know, what are you wearing? But what they are wearing is, some of it is, you know, more humorous get-ups, you know, just to kind of make a bit of a spectacle and be part of the protest. And some of it, you know, people are wearing protection because they're expecting to be tear gassed, right? Mm-hmm. So it's asking this question that is like parodying a very popular media format, but it kind of takes it in this whole other direction, right?
And so as it relates to the resistance to free trade and resistance to these broader issues that you're addressing in the book, how are these materials contrasted, or how do they relate to the material from earlier in the book where it is about forging ties and building connections? Like are these things in conflict with each other?
Yeah, I mean, and I think they're telling different stories about North America and what it means, and in some cases the artwork is intended to be a direct rebuttal to some of these exhibitions and a lot of the government activity. There is a lot of opposition to free trade amongst Canadian cultural producers and artists, and people were using art to get the message out, and they were using art at protests, and they're also kind of creating just critical artworks to work through these issues. So I can give you a few examples. One that you could understand that slightly predates the period I focused on is from 1972, and it's a map by London artist Greg Curnow. It's called Map of North America, and what Curnow has done is he's refigured North America to eliminate the U.S. So he's created this map that stitches together Canada and Mexico. That's a work that's in the Dalhousie Art Collection. So I think that just gives you a sense of how artists are thinking critically about Canada and its place in the world. But in terms of free trade, more specifically, there's a great work. There's two works I'd like to mention. So one is a video work by Antonia Hirsch, and it is a large-scale video installation that shows three conductors, their sight reading the anthems of Canada, Mexico, and the United States. And it's really this commentary on nationalism and national economic policy and what it means, and also cues our thinking to these national signifiers, you know, anthems, flags, all these symbols that help us understand what the nation is a part of. And the other artwork I'd love to highlight is by Peter Dykus. It's called State Dinner. It's an installation from 2005, and it's the artwork that's on the cover of the book. And so what you're seeing is a collection of 95 paper plates on which the artist has carefully rendered the province, territory, or state in Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. And so these are arranged alphabetically. So it's, if you're thinking about artist mapping, it's a different way to think about North America, to be confronted with all of its component parts.
Yeah, that's really cool. That see, now that's art I can understand, right? I can.
Not all art is for everyone, and I think it's okay to take what you can from different artworks.
Yeah. So should note that this book is coming out in 2025, and yes. The process of putting all this work together, because these things take a lot of effort and a lot of time to do so. You have spanned now multiple administrations that have. Well, the same individual leading it, but multiple administrations that have pushed to address or renegotiate free trade in North America. How has the current context and the current environment shaped the way that the book is written about, or changed the way the book is written, or if it has at all, or just in general, the way that you are thinking about these broader ideas, given that they are still very front and center for a lot of folks?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a very strange moment in which to be releasing this book. When I did the initial bulk of research, I was thinking more about the, you know, different anniversaries of NAFTA and how we understand it now versus what was happening in the moment. And then we had, you know, the Trump administration in its first term, in which NAFTA was, again, you know, really part of that election, really on the fore, and was renegotiated and transformed into the Canada U.S.-Mexico agreement. As you'll note, this North America is kind of taken out of that acronym, and we're in a very, there's a lot less rhetoric around unity. We're not seeing surges of kind of cultural initiatives trying to message linkages between all our countries. Now, under the second term of the Trump administration, we're in the midst of a trade war, and we're also seeing a resurgent Canadian nationalism, and it is this very different moment. And so the research for the book, I think that the latest thing I talk about is around 2019, and I note renegotiation of NAFTA and the Canada-US-Mexico agreement, and it wraps up there. We couldn't say much more, but I think that was a really great moment for me as a researcher in order to think about this promotion of North American unity happening through art as being but one moment in the history of North America. So in the book at the beginning, I talk a bit about the ambiguity around North America connections and how we haven't always considered the three North American states tightly knit together. And I think we're in this other moment right now where we can see that very clearly, right? There's a lot of antagonism. The rhetoric is really sharp in terms of differences between Canada and the US. And so artworks like Greg Curnow's Map of North America, which amid the US have this new interesting resonance in this moment, right, that we wouldn't have thought about. So it was hard to find an end point for the book discussions, but I felt that concluding it just before 2020 was a good moment to do so.
Yeah, and certainly 2020 brings a whole host of other cultural issues and questions and artistic priorities and things that are happening. So I understand why you'd want to end the book there for sure.
And I would say, too, the other thing that was useful to me in terms of picking that end date for the book has to do with changes in cultural diplomacy. So there's different currents running through the book, but kind of understanding Canadian cultural diplomacy throughout is part of it. And we see, you know, a lot of engagement between External Affairs and National Gallery of Canada in the early 20th century. And we see kind of a heyday of cultural diplomacy in the late 20th century, where culture is espoused as the third pillar of Canadian cultural policy. That's a very big moment. And then what we have is a real step back from cultural diplomacy in the aughts under the Harper administration. But then with the Trudeau coming back into power, we see, again, attention to cultural diplomacy and eventually a Senate study that takes place in 2017. And so as part of the book is trying to unpack this history and also parse out a bit what people are saying about commitment to cultural diplomacy versus what is actually happening in terms of funding and programs running. So that's another thread of the book that I think is important to know about.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'd certainly encourage everybody to check it out. There's a lot in there. And as you can tell, I am not an expert on art. You can tell from my questions, but I love this stuff. I love whenever Sarah comes on and explains stuff to me. And I think anyone who picks up the book will very much enjoy it. So again, it is Trading on Art, Cultural Diplomacy in North America. Sarah, if people want to pick up a copy of the book or just follow along with everything you got going on, which is a lot, because as I said, you're also a curator doing a lot of stuff. What's the best way for them to keep up with everything you got going on?
Yes, you can certainly look at my website, sarahekesmith.com. The book comes out May 1st with UBC Press. And so check out Trading on Art, Cultural Diplomacy, and Free Trade in North America.
All right. And we will link to all of that down below in the show notes. So please do go and check it out. Sarah E. K. Smith, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Sean. It's been a great discussion.
So there you have it, my chat with Sarah E. K. Smith, and I thank her for her time. And again, the book is Trading on Art, Cultural Diplomacy and Free Trade in North America. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which today is going to come from The Guardian, a staff article from December 4th, 2024, entitled Mexico Says Canada Wishes It Had Its Cultural Riches Among Tariffs Feud. And this article is reporting on Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum's statement that Canadians, quote, could only wish they had the cultural riches of her country as the tensions mounted late last year on tariffs. This was, of course, before the inauguration of President Trump. And there was still some uncertainty about what the tariff situation would look like following the change of administrations from President Biden to President Trump. And there was a lot going on in terms of everybody was trying to state their case and make their point. And certainly, as was the case here with President Sheinbaum, making reference to the cultural side of international trade, international diplomacy. This was prior to the resignation of Justin Trudeau as prime minister. And the context of this particular comment came with respect to fentanyl and the public discourse surrounding fentanyl and the problem of fentanyl deaths in Canada and the United States. And President Sheinbaum made this comment and noted that she didn't think Mexico should be a party or should be part of Canadian electoral campaigns, which she felt her country was being launched into the what was then impending election campaign here in Canada. So it was quite interesting. And Sarah actually brought this article to my attention, noting that here's this case where we're talking again about mostly manufactured goods, a little bit about resources, but here we go with President Sheinbaum talking about culture and the role of culture. It still has a place in these broader discussions. So a really fascinating insight into how these questions that Sarah talks about in the book still very much have a place in the conversation. So today's historical headline of the week from The Guardian on December 4, 2024, Mexico says Canada wishes it had its cultural riches amid tariffs feud. And with that, I'll say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, like, rate, comment, all that good stuff helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab, plus all the great written material over on the website. And if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, whatsoldisnews@gmail.com. So with that, I'll say thanks so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Old Is News.